Good morning and welcome to the Tuesday Morning Zine on KSJD. I'm Tom Yoder, and with me here this morning on the Big Fat Farm Show are Sarah Severson. She's your regular host of the Big Fat Farm Show, taking over for her today. And she's also with the Montezuma School to Farm project. She's the project director. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Also joining us in the studio is Bob Bragg. He's the co-host of Ag Markets and More here on KSJD and a longtime farmer and agriculture educator. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, Tom.
Well, we're convening here this morning because of an article that my colleague Mark Dugan handed to me about a month ago. It's titled, What Farm to Table Got Wrong. It was written by Dan Barber in the New York Times. It was published on May 18th. The article talks about how the farm-to-table movement in America may have fallen short. Over the past decade, big agriculture has gotten bigger with more farmland consolidated into fewer hands that's more dedicated to crops like corn and soy. And it's also about why small farmers who grow for a local population may be working twice as hard to ensure their food crops measure up to their consumers' expectations. So really two big questions emerge from this. How do we make sense of this local food revolution on one hand, but an entrenched status quo on the other? And is growing specialized food crops for farm-to-table sustainable for small-scale farmers? So I'm going to try to unpack a bunch of stuff here today on the Big Fat Farm Show. Bob, let's start with you. This idea that big ag is just getting bigger, is that really playing out in the numbers that you see?
Yes. If you take a look at the census of agriculture numbers that just came out, we're seeing about 95,000 more less farms, and if you take a look at those farms that are over 2,000 acres, there's 3,000 more of those. So, and it's really kind of coming from the mid, in essence, family-sized farms are decreasing in numbers considerably. The only number of farms from 1 to 1,999 acres is the 1 to 9-acre farms. We saw a 6,000 increase in those. So there's a huge decrease in the numbers of farms when you get into kind of the mid-range. In other words, what we would call small or family-sized farms have decreased. And, you know, if you take a look at the what's happening there, it's just we really are focusing most of our energy on those large-scale farms.
And it almost, what you're saying, if I'm hearing it correctly, we're almost seeing like this increase in these almost like micro-sized farms, this 1 to 6 acre, which is maybe where a lot of this sort of farm-to-table movement is actually happening. Sarah, you read this article, and you took some exception to some of the numbers and some of the things that were presented in there. Can you talk about some of the things that you were like, this doesn't quite ring true with me?
Well, I think I had some opposition to the idea that farm-to-table isn't changing anything. I think they're part of this larger movement that's happening around education, growing more local foods, that it's sort of a tipping point that takes time to get to that point, and it is a big industry. So to change that, those old habits and ways of doing things takes more than 10 years to do. You know, so I think that's what I was mainly taking to, you know, not totally agreeing with. I think the other thing that's interesting with what Bob brought up is that the fact that small-scale farming is increasing. There was a National Geographic article that talked about worldwide there's 5 million family farmers that are 5 acres or less that's feeding 56% of the population. So that's a pretty, you know, significant portion of the population, and not to rule out those small-scale farmers.
So really, big ag is getting bigger, but so is small farming.
Small.
It's also getting bigger. So that's interesting. One of the other things that this article by Dan Barber in the New York Times talks about is this idea that there's a misconception or this idea that farming is very simple on this small scale. You grow your crop, you send it to the farmer's market, and then you do that over again. But really, what the article points out really well is that this is really a lot about the soil and the health of your soil and what you're doing with it. Bob, can you kind of walk us through a little bit about what farmers need to consider as it relates to soil? And I know we could go on for hours about that, but walk us through some of the complications around soil.
Well, I think soil really became apparent back during the Dust Bowl days in the 30s when we saw huge amounts of soil being blown clear into the East Coast and beyond. And that the National Resource Conservation Service was started to help to conserve our soil. And that's really been kind of the focus for decades, was to keep soil from moving off of the fields by either water or wind. And they really didn't talk much about soil health. In other words, the microbes in the soil and the tilth, the fertility, because we keep adding, you know, we can add commercial fertilizer to bring the fertility up, and the tilth, it doesn't really matter. And if you don't have any earthworms in there, it's just kind of like we've been treating the soil as if it were just some sort of a grow medium. And if we add enough chemicals to it, we're going to make it all work. I think that one thing that I see that the small-scale farming has really kind of brought to the front is that we need to be looking at a complete soil health and how that affects what we grow, because we can't afford in the future to keep putting the amounts of commercial fertilizers that we have that we are doing currently. And I think that we're paying more attention to issues like cover crops to protect the soil in the wintertime so that it isn't blowing away, as well as bringing nutrients up from the subsoil with those many of those plants will actually reach down and pull up the phosphorus and the potassium that's needed for a crop. And then because we have more organic matter in the soil, and we are using cover crops that that pull nitrogen from the air, that we can cut back on that fertilizer. However, you know, we take a look at this on a small scale. When you get to the larger scale, that doesn't seem to be in the common practices that many large-scale farmers do.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Big Fat Farm Show. This is the Tuesday Morning Zine. I'm Tom Yoder, and this morning we're talking about farm-to-table and some of the complexities around the farm-to-table movement and the food revolution, the local food revolution that's going on. Joining me this morning in the studio is your regular host of the Big Fat Farm Show, Sarah Severson. She's also with the Montezuma School to Farm Project, and Bob Bragg, co-host of Ag Markets and More here on KSJD. Sarah, Bob's talking about a pretty complex arrangement around making sure the soil is there for farming. Are you hearing anything locally here with farmers around some of the challenges that they have around soil and some of the costs and inputs that they need to put into their soil?
Well, I think there's been a lot of exciting things, like Bob was saying, around soil health and things like cover cropping using green manure and crop rotation that some farmers have been using, small-scale farmers have been using for years and years. It's definitely easier to do on a smaller scale, and it's practices that are being implemented on a regular basis with small-scale farmers with not a lot of, you get a lot better crop yields from doing those practices, so it's an obvious yes to doing those things.
Okay. So, yeah. Bob, how do you see... We're talking a little bit about sort of the influences on big ag, on small, and some of the influences with small-scale agriculture on big ag. Do you see that there is those influences happening? Are big ag producers looking to some of the small-scale producers for, hey, there's things I can do differently on a larger scale?
There may be some, but I think that there's almost an adversarial relationship there big agriculture is, in essence, badmouths small-scale ag, and they go on about how we can't produce enough food using the small-scale approach, and that we really need to go to the large-scale farms and the huge equipment in order to produce enough food and fiber for the world, and that small-scale ag is just a little drop in the bucket. And, you know, there's some at this point in time, you take a look at the total food production, the total crop production, and there's probably some truth in that. But I think that there's the problem we have in agriculture is that the large scale ag needs to be careful who they bash, because we may all be needing to use these techniques that are being developed by small scale agriculture.
Sarah, are you seeing that play out from the kind of small-scale farmer end, that there is this kind of adversarial relationship between the really big agricultural producers and the smaller? It does seem like that is the case, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think Bob's right that we need to work together, that it's not just going to be the small-scale producers that'll save the food system. It will also be the large-scale producers and working with each other, you know, to be able to take the benefit that each of those systems can, you know, can learn from each other. It reminds me of like holistic medicine or alternative medicine and conventional medicine. You know, I'm being able to go to the doctor if I have a broken arm, I'm probably not going to go to my naturopath. I'm probably going to go to the emergency room, and thank goodness for the emergency room. But if I need to change my diet and look at some nutritional deficiencies that I have, I'll probably go to the naturopath, to the alternative medicine practitioner. So it's the same way with small scale and large scale producers. And I also think things like the organic movement that, you know, have been happening over the last 20, 30 years, mm-hmm. that started with small scale producers. And now you've got it in, you know, that didn't used to be in the supermarkets in the 80s and 90s. And now you can go in and buy, you know, organic milk, organic cheese. There's pretty much in every aisle, there's an organic option. So it does turn mainstream. I think there's benefits to both ends of the system.
And like you were saying earlier, it may take a lot more time for this sort of, you know, trajectory to play itself out and for change to really look more apparent on a national scale than it does right now.
Yeah, but it does seem like it's moving pretty, it seems like it's moving pretty fast, and we all have to be patient as well.
All right. You're listening to the Big Fat Farm Show on the Tuesday Morning Zine. I'm Tom Yoder. We're going to take a short break, and we'll talk a little bit more here in just a minute about farm to table. We're back. This is the Big Fat Farm Show on KSJD. I'm Tom Yoder, taking over for Sarah Severson this morning, but she's right here in the studio with me. Sarah is, of course, your regular host for the Big Fat Farm Show, and she's also the Montezuma School to Farm Project Director. And joining us also here in the studio this morning is Bob Bragg. He's a longtime farmer and agricultural teacher, and he's the co-host of Ag Markets and More here on KSJD. This morning, we're talking about some issues that were brought up in an article that appeared in the New York Times on May 18th called What Farm to Table Got Wrong. It was written by Dan Barber. I think one of the things that this article is talking about, and really what we're talking about, is this sort of idea of this food revolution. And is there really a food revolution happening? And I'd like to kind of get each of your perspectives on that, because there's a lot of different angles around a food revolution. Bob, do you see anything really changing that you would call a revolution as it relates to food right now in America?
Yes, I believe so. And the big revolution is that people are more aware of their food. I think we've moved back to the point where cooking has become popular again. And that experimentation with the various foods that go into a meal are quite a bit different than they were in the 50s when I was a kid. You know, it was really kind of going to this almost pre-prepared food idea. And I think that as we look at the variety that we find in vegetables and meats and everything else that we see in farmers markets and in grocery stores is just really a big, that probably is a huge revolution. And that requires people who are producing those items to kind of move beyond the commonplace as far as the production methods. So they have to be experimenting a little bit in order to be able to produce some of those food items.
Sarah, would you agree that there is a food revolution happening?
Yeah, absolutely. from where I sit, definitely, I see it. Yeah. Yeah, I think it's interesting to me because we work with pre-K through 12th grade with Montezuma School to Farm Project, and we're seeing a lot of interest in education happening, obviously, in our school garden programs, but that's happening around the nation, too. Our staff went to the National Farm to School Convention in Austin this year, and they gave us a statistic that in 1996, there were 8 school garden programs, and now there are 38,000
Wow.
in 2014. So that's very expansive over that period of years. But I also think of that, just that young population, that teens, 20-somethings, early 30-somethings that are interested in farming and small-scale production. You know, a lot of them don't have the resources to buy a large-scale farm or aren't coming from traditionally farming families, so they're not inheriting those large pieces of land. But they can start out with 1 acre, 2 acres, 10 acres, and start experimenting, like with what Bob said. It's easier to experiment with an acre of quinoa than 10,000 acres of quinoa. If that 10,000 acres fails, you know,
a little less risk there.
A little less risk, yeah. So they're great experimental stations, experimental laboratories for looking down the road at larger scale production.
Well, and it sounds like what both of you are saying is that this food revolution is really consumer driven. It's not being driven necessarily by agriculture, but
That's
the
right.
consumers are saying, we want something different. Can you, either of you, want to speak to that a little bit?
I think that's where it started. You started to see that as we saw farmers markets start to come back. You know, during World War II, there were victory gardens, and then it kind of the whole gardening phase dropped out. And then we started to see this where people just started to say, wait, I want to be able to grow something in my myself, or I want to see something different than delicious apples in the supermarket. I want to see all these apples that are that were grown in the past, that they started to see that there was more out there than what was the same. It's like pork. If you buy pork in this country, it's kind of the same pork, whether you go, whatever store you go to. Where in other countries, there are, every region will have a different breed of pork, and every region has a different flavor in Spain and in Italy. And I think that people started to travel and see that, and they started to say, hey, wait, we need to do something. We need to have some diversity in our diet.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think also the industrial revolution of the what's been happening in the food industry for the last 50, 60 years has driven those changes too. You know, people, all the sort of salmonella or epidemics that are happening, like with the ag markets and more. They were talking this morning. Bob was talking about the pork industry getting wiped out by some kind of virus that was happening large scale. But then I think small scale here in Montezuma County, Cecilia Berto and Berto's farm, you know, all the beautiful pigs that she raises, we get that specifically raised in this area. I don't know that she's being affected by that large scale virus that's happening because she's not raising her pigs in that way.
Yeah, well, I think that you look at all of that. And the problem is, I think that the other factor is that with these small-scale farms, they are experimenting. They're experimenting with the soils. And something that we're not doing on the scale when it comes to USDA Agricultural Research Service or even state experiment stations, we're not doing that. We're kind of really focused on the large-scale agriculture, and we're not focusing as much energy on finding out how we can make that 1 acre be very productive, very highly productive. We want to see what we can do on the large scale, and we're worried about the number of bushels of corn or soybeans we're growing, but not the number of pounds of vegetables that we can produce, where these small-scale farmers are, in essence, taking the place of what we used to do with agricultural research.
Yeah, and I think that point around, you know, I think about the advent of the supermarkets in 1950. Before that, 50% of the food was raised in backyard gardens. So just to not discount the value of a small-scale plot and how much you can actually raise in a small area of your backyard, or if you have a 1 to 9 acre farm, there's actually quite a bit of production that's possible there.
But I think part of the danger is oversimplifying some of that. It's like, oh, we'll just have a backyard garden and it'll be this new food. I mean, there are a lot of, as we were talking about earlier, there's a lot of complicated parts to farming, even at a small scale. Let's finish up here. I'd like to hear from each of you. What are some, maybe some misconceptions, or what are some things that consumers need to keep in mind? If this, the whole thing, this food revolution that we're talking about, is driven by the consumer, what are the things that the consumer needs to keep in mind when they're going to either the supermarket or the farmer's market or wherever they're going to buy their food?
I think one of the things, and this comes from the economist in me, is that we need to realize that producing food on the smaller scale is going to cost more. I mean, it's just cost more in the way of human energy, and it costs more in the way of we're not producing it on the huge scale. So I think we kind of have to get rid of the idea that food is cheap and it's always going to be cheap, and if it's not cheap, then we're not going to buy it.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. You know, America spends the least amount of money of any country on food. We're heavily commodified and subsidized, and we don't know what the actual cost of the food is. So to know that when you buy that tomato, behind that is the cover crop that got planted for that tomato, the human energy that went into that, that soil health, that farmer's life, livelihood. And then also thinking of food as a medicine, preventative medicine, also valuing the diversity in the food supply so that we're not just buying corn and soy products, but that we get a nutrient rainbow of goods from local producers, large scale and small scale, and being willing to spend an extra $5 to $10 a week on local food increases the local food economy, helps that local farmer. It's not that much out of your pocket to be able to help support that movement and your own health.
Absolutely. You get what you pay for, I guess.
Yep.
All right. Well, we'll have to leave it there for now. Thank you both for being here this morning. Bob Bragg, co-host of Ag Markets and More here on KSJD, and Sarah Severson, our regular host of the Big Fat Farm Show and the Montezuma School to Farm Project Director. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you, Tom.